Are you ready for new dimensions and countless possibilities today and for the future? It's an exciting new time, and the answers are out there. So join Mary Jane Popp as she explores the unique and unusual for a better life on Pop Talk in search of the truth. And here she is, Mary Jane Popp.
And welcome to Pop Talk. Thanks, Mike. I appreciate that introduction. Yeah, we got a good one this hour. This is hour two of Pop Talk, and we're going to go the whole nine yards on this one. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking with Dan Luzader. He wrote a book called The Manchurian Journalist. When you really think about what we're getting in the media today, whether it's radio, television, print, magazine, doesn't matter, the internet especially, and social media, is it really true? We don't know. I mean, I don't know if journalism even exists anymore, not true, real journalism. So we're going to get a good discussion on that. But anyway, how about your health? I love talking about the health because you can take it from so many different aspects. Like, is it really physical? Is it psychological? Is it a combination? How many of you know a hypochondriac? You know what that is, right? It's people who are complaining all the time. They've got so many illnesses you can't even keep track of them. You'd have to have a dictionary with you to figure them out. And they probably don't have anything wrong. Well, there's a whole lot of that going on, but we're going to find out what you can do when your body actually can speak to you. Anyway, stay with us. It's Pop Talk. We always bring you our search for truth.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good.
Well, I hope you do. Because, you know, we don't ever know whether sometimes if it's for real, am I just thinking I'm having some problems? But have you ever been to a doctor with a major concern? You know, you're afraid. You got cancer. You got a heart problem. Whatever. Only to have them tell you, it's all in your head. Well, Dr. E, that's Dr. Efrat Lamandre, says it's not in your head and your body may be speaking to you. Now, she's passionate about promoting longevity. Dr. E says that you can achieve peak performance at any age. Now, I wonder about that one. I hope she's right. Dr. E is reshaping actually healthcare. She's a best-selling author of over 5 million and has over 5 million followers. You'll find it all that we're talking about and more in her book called It's Not in Your Head. Dr. E, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Fantastic. Okay. You say it may not be a mental thing, but how do I know if I'm not a hypochondriac?
Well, I don't know if I can tell you how you're not a hypochondriac. I'm going to assume that for most of us, we're not hypochondriacs. There is a very small segment of the population that maybe fits that technical term, hypochondriac, but I think it's used too loosely and too frequently to actually dismiss people. So it's my contention that what happens to people is that they don't feel well, aches and pains or brain fog, and they go to their medical provider, the doctor, the NPPA, and they run some tests, and maybe the tests come back normal, or maybe they just have a minor thing. And so then the medical provider says, oh, you know, nothing, everything is fine. Maybe it's your anxiety, maybe it's your stress, or maybe it's just in your head. And I consider that to be a form of medical gaslighting. It might not be malicious, but I do think it's medical gaslighting. We can get into that in a little bit, but I wanted to answer that question first.
But how do I know if maybe they're right? Maybe I am just worrying too, or I worry too much. I get a pain. Oh, my God. You know, I wonder if that's my liver or my, you know, whatever. You don't know.
Well, I think it depends on how much it's affecting your daily living. If you're just curious, like, oh, just hurt me for 1 second, then you move along with your day. It's a different story. But if it's really affecting your daily living, you say to yourself, really, I'm not performing the way I used to. You know, I used to be able to concentrate. I used to be able to, you know, play with my grandkids. And if it's really affecting your daily living, if you're not able to perform whatever performance means to you in the same way, then it's not in your head. It's physical. And that needs to be addressed, even if all your tests are normal.
Yeah, but, you know, as we get older, we kind of slow down a little bit. I mean, you know, we can't run those marathons as much as we used to, especially when you get into your 70s and late 70s, you know. What do you think?
I think that we've normalized a certain way of aging that doesn't have to be. And I think that even saying, you know, you can't do that at 70, I think that is not true. I think if we focus on, listen, there is no doubt that a certain amount of aging happens, right? The mitochondria changes, our skin changes, our joints have been worn. But I think we accept much more as a normal part of aging than we should. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that our medical system searches for a pathology, a sickness.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have a sickness, you're not diabetic, your cholesterol is not high, then you're told you're fine. I'll see you next year.
Yeah.
But the absence of illness is not the same as wellness. When we don't spend enough time spending with our patients talking about wellness. And so we're like, oh, a little bit of brain fog, your joints hurt, that's fine. Why is it fine? Because you don't have a sickness. And so we've normalized this process of unwellness because we've defined it as you're not sick, and that should be good enough. Then once the wheels fall off and you're sick and you're diagnosed, then, you know, everyone's there with their tools and their medications and their procedures. But what happened to all those years of decline? Why is there no intervention during those years of decline?
What kind of intervention?
Oh, my goodness, there's so much intervention. So imagine a world where if you came in your 40s or your 50s and you're like, you know, I really have brain fog. And imagine a world where we took that brain fog seriously and we said, you know what? That's not just because you're busy. That's not because you're a mom or a dad. That's actually a very, very early sign of dementia in your 40s and in your 50s.
Wow.
What would it look like if we said, oh, my goodness, we're not going to accept this brain fog. Let's get to the root cause of the brain fog and fix that so that the brain fog doesn't continue to get worse and worse and worse until ultimately dementia. What would it look like if someone said, you know, my joints hurt me at 30, at 40, and instead of saying, well, what do you expect at 30 or 40, we actually intervene right then and there instead of waiting to the point where we're 16, 70, and now we need knee replacement. And there's a lot that we could do. But let's start with nutrition. I mean, nutrition, Alzheimer's is considered type 3 diabetes. Type 3 diabetes. The same nutrition that gets you type 2 diabetes gets you Alzheimer's.
Really?
So that brain fog, you can look at that as almost like a pre-diabetes. Why are you eating so many carbs? What is happening with your nutrition that you caused such neuroinflammation that now you have brain fog? So you see, it's a whole different way of thinking of things.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I just had on, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Earl Mandel.
No, I'm not familiar.
Okay. Well, he wrote the original Vitamin Bible. He's a pharmacist, has been into nutrition and all this kind of thing. And, you know, we were talking about the same kind of things with nutrition. You shouldn't have the sugar. I mean, we are sugar addicts, let's face it. But I said, when I was growing up, which is a long time ago, we had bread and we had all these sweet things. I'm Romanian by descent, so if you didn't have a whole bunch of goodies on the table, all kinds of things. But he said that was a time when it was real bread and real pastry. And he said, it's not the same today. Do you agree?
100%. Also, that was a time when we didn't have high fructose corn syrup and everything.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, we have sugar in our ketchup. We have sugar in things that are salty.
Yeah.
We have sugar everywhere. So by the time we get to the candy, you know, back in the day, you had a candy and then you had some sort of nutritious meal, even if it was one a day. Not all of us, you know, had two or three meals, but you weren't constantly inundated with sugar.
Yeah.
I mean, who had access to so much, you know, lattes and sodas and Gatorade? Like, you didn't have access to that. We drank water. Maybe it was sweetened sometimes with something, but most of the time you drank water. So it's not the sugar by itself that's evil. It's the sugar in the context of everything else. I agree 100% with that.
Okay. So if one of the things that you say in your book is, if your body doesn't feel right, but you don't know why, then what do you do?
Excellent question. So the first thing you always do, you always go to your PCP. You never skip that step. You want to start in conventional medicine. I love conventional medicine. I practice it every Monday. The rest of the week, I practice integrative medicine. But conventional medicine is important. You don't want to say, oh, I think I have a gluten allergy, and you've never had an endoscopy, right? So do go to your PCP. Go to the specialist that he or she sends you to, the GI, the neuro, whatever they send you. Always start that road because you want to rule out a sickness first. Now, if there's a sickness, a diagnosis, certainly you're going to have to take care of it. But if you come out and they say, clean bill of health, Mr. Smith, you have no sickness, and you say, yeah, but I really don't feel well, that's when you have to say, okay, I've used the tools of conventional medicine. I've used it to its max. I've seen all my specialists. They found nothing. Great news. Now I have to use a different tool. And that's when you turn over to, like, integrative or functional or holistic, whatever's in the neighborhood near you, and you say, listen, I went to my doctor, my MP, my PA. They told me everything's fine. I don't feel fine. When you go to your integrative or functional medicine provider, they have a whole host of testing and treatment approaches that your conventional medicine doctor does not have. Not better, not worse, different. And now you have to explore those. So I'll give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
A patient, this is all real case studies over the years that I've been practicing. A patient who has balance issues and has been to every neurologist, every MRI and CAT scan done, and consistently advised everything is fine. Turns out that this patient had severe gluten sensitivity. And in their case, the gluten sensitivity was causing neuroinflammation and balance issues.
Huh.
This person did not have celiac. This person would not come up positive for any celiac testing, just the gluten sensitivity. So this is a person who will go in conventional medicine all day long and consistently get a clean bill of health. But when they go to integrative medicine and is taken up gluten, gets their balance back, no longer motion sickness, able to go on train rides. These are real stories. I'll give you another example. The person with chronic headaches who's been to every neurologist, given a lot of medication. She's like, I don't want medication. I want to know why I have the headache.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have a tumor. She's had the scan. Everything's been done. No hormonal imbalances. Constantly told that she's fine. Maybe she's stressed. This is somebody that turns out has mold in her basement, and her home office is in the basement. So every single day, she was just
exposed.
Full of the mold toxicity.
But
she remediated her home. We remediated her. Headaches are gone.
But
this is what I mean.
But what drives me crazy is that as you get older, people who are on Medicare, they call their yearly exam a wellness check. Well, you know what that means?
That's a lie.
We'll listen to your heart. We'll look in your ears. We'll check your throat. Look in your eyes. And how do you feel? Well, I'm okay. All right, you're done. That's it. That's what they call a wellness check now.
That's exactly my point, that wellness in conventional medicine means lack of illness.
Yeah.
But that's not wellness.
So what do I tell my doctor? Hey, you should be doing more tests because I don't feel good.
No. Nope. You say, thank you so much. I'm so glad you found nothing on your exam. That's great news. And then you go elsewhere. There's no point in getting frustrated with a doctor. There's no point in asking a doctor to run more tests. He or she already ran all the tests. And you can't ask an electrician to do plumbing, right? You go to an electrician for electricity. You go to a plumber for plumbing. If your conventional medicine doc says, I've done everything I could, you say, that's great news. Thank you so much. And you move on to someone else.
Yeah, but the problem is if you go to holistic or a naturopath, insurances don't cover that. You better have some
That's
bucks.
Correct. That's correct. They don't cover it.
And the cost ain't cheap.
The cost is not cheap, but being sick is more expensive.
Oh, yeah, I know. I understand that. And believe me, I have a holistic doctor that I refer to. But I have to kind of be careful because every time you walk in, you're going to walk out with a hefty little bill. So you better be ready for it,
100%. I mean, the conventional medicine doctor also creates a bill. You just don't feel it, right, because it goes through insurance.
Yeah.
But it's true. Staying healthy in this country requires an out-of-pocket expense, without question.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, it does.
And as you get older, it seems like they dismiss you faster. It's like
100%. It's easy to dismiss. Women are dismissed more because they're either perimenopausal or postmenopausal, or they're pregnant, right? So you can blame everything on hormones.
Mm-hmm.
Older people are, well, what do you expect? You're 65, you're 75. There is not an expectation that you could feel optimal at any age. And so you're completely dismissed. Minorities are dismissed even more.
Mm.
These are well-established facts. You are 100% correct.
Yeah.
Women, minorities, and older adults are dismissed more easily, without question.
Amazing. And I also blame gravity. Don't forget gravity. Because I said, well, you know, really, the first 40 years of your life, you should walk upright. Then after that, start walking on your hands upside down so that everything goes back where it's supposed to go.
That's a great tip.
Yeah, it is. And I was talking with Dr. Mandel about belly fat. Why is it that you see more people, older people, and you see this even in if you see watch a TV series that was maybe on 15 years ago or 20 years ago, and then you see the person 20 years later, they're thicker around the middle. Why is that?
Because the standard American diet is full of carbs. And what happens with carbs is... So let's just explain for like a brief moment for our listeners, like how kind of carbs are utilized. So carbs, everything we eat becomes glucose, and then glucose is our fuel. We need glucose to live. So we break it down to glucose, and then insulin is kind of like Uber. It picks up the glucose as a passenger, brings it over to the cell, and then the cell says, thank you so much, I really needed this snack, and it does its thing. If we keep eating more carbs, as most Americans do, and insulin brings it to the cell after a while says, no thanks, I just had a snack, I don't need any more. So now the insulin doesn't know what to do with its glucose. It really has to find a place for it. If it drops it in blood, that's diabetes. So it's going to do everything it can to not drop it in the blood. For years and years and years, it's going to try not to drop it in the blood. And so it has to start storing it in places. It stores it as cholesterol, it stores it as triglycerides, and it stores it in fat around our organs. That's why central obesity is more dangerous than obesity in other parts of the body.
Mm.
Because this fat is fat that's coating the organs. It's what's called visceral fat. And that's actually dangerous fat. And it's actually part of what we call metabolic syndrome, which is, insulin resistance is part of that. And if left unchecked and you keep doing that, you will develop diabetes. So the reason we see more and more, and by the way, I see it in younger and younger people as well,
because they start much younger.
The reason now we see it older, because most of us, when we were younger, had a pretty decent nutrition, and we really got into standard American diet as we aged. Now, because I do pediatrics as well, I see a lot of heavy young people because they're introduced to the standard American diet that much younger. So the central obesity is a pandemic in this country.
Mm.
An epidemic, I should say. And, so that's the reason why. It is a sign of insulin resistance. It's a sign of carb overload. And it's a sign of the body just not able to manage all the food that's being given.
Okay, well, let me ask you, Dr. E, what do you eat?
Oh, I love that question. So, first of all, I'm a huge fan of intermittent fasting, which means eat for 8 hours, and I fast for 16 hours. So what that looks like is, let's just say my last meal was at 8 o'clock. My next meal the next day is at 11. So you want to try to get 16 hours of fasting time. What that does
all the time?
Every day.
Wow.
Every day, at least 16 hours. And, of course, if you're listening, run this by a medical provider. This would be difficult for people who are insulin. This is not necessarily something you should do if you're pregnant or nursing. So there are outliers. So please make sure to, vet this through.
You can't do that to your kids, can you?
For your kids, no. You don't want to do that with children as well.
Mm-hmm.
So for our, let's just say our general demographic, 45 and up, unless they have, contraindication, this would be highly recommended. What happens in those 16 hours is a few things. First of all, it's an anti-inflammatory state. It's a state where inflammation in your body just calms down. Your aches and pains will be better. Your brain fog will be better. Just things are just better. Second, it's really helps create insulin sensitivity, right? We don't want to be resistant. We want to be sensitive. So it helps create insulin sensitivity. And for anyone who's trying to lose weight, if that's important to you, it also helps weight loss. Then, during the 8 hours, my number one priority is to try to get between 100 to 120 grams of protein. And that's challenging to do in 8 hours. So I need a protein shake. I need amino acid supplements. And then I have 2 to 3 meals, depending on how active I am. And then my second priority after protein is to make sure I have a lot of phytonutrients. And that's a fancy word for a lot of colors on my plate. Many colors as possible.
Yeah, but you're not eating very often. I mean, how do you put all that on one plate?
Yeah, so I wait. So when I do break my fast, I break my fast with a protein shake. So I already get some protein in there. Then after that, I drink a green drink, which has a lot of, like, vegetables in there. And I also add some, like, polyphenols. That's like a supplemental way to get some of those rainbows in. Then I have my lunch. My lunch will have a protein and a lot of vegetables in there. My snack will try to be, you know, nuts and a fruit.
Wait a minute. I'm confused.
Yeah.
I have breakfast. See, I start out.
Well, it's not really breakfast.
No, no, no. I mean,
it's like breaking the fast. Yeah.
Okay. Let's say I'm in the morning. I get up and I want to have something in me because I haven't eaten for a long time. So I have something. Then after I have that, I wait 16 hours. Explain.
The last meal is 8 p.m.
8 p.m.?
My first meal is 11 a.m.
Okay. And then 8 p.m.
So nothing is happening. I'm fasting in the morning.
Okay, so from 8 till 11 the next morning.
Say it again?
If I eat at 11 a.m., you say you eat at 11 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
So 11 to 7, 12 to 8 is like the window to eat.
11 to 7. Oh, okay. I'm still confused. I get up in the morning. When should I eat?
It all depends on when your last meal was the night before.
Well, I'm starting all over. Let's say I'm starting all over, and I got to ignore everything that I've done prior to that. So when do
you
I start?
You have to start from the night before.
Okay.
When was your last meal then last night? Let's just give me your meal.
Is that with or without snacks?
No snacks. The last thing you put in your body at night.
Okay, probably about 10 o'clock.
Okay, that's a little late. So at 10 o'clock...
Yeah, I don't go to bed till 1 o'clock.
Okay, well, you have a whole different thing we have to talk about.
Oh,
because
okay.
Because that's sleep deprivation. It's not great for your brain. But let's use...
Wait a minute, who said I'm having sleep deprivation?
If you're up at 1 o'clock,
yeah,
then you are working against the internal circadian rhythm.
So in other words, when do I have to go to bed?
You want to try to really be in line with the planet. You want to try to go to sleep, you know, earlier, and you want to try to wake up with the sun. Obviously, we can't do it exactly. But you want to try to be awake.
Depends on what time of year. Come on.
Right. That's why I said it's not exact.
Yeah.
But you want your circadian rhythm to be in line as much as possible with light and dark.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And we could spend some time on that, but I want to finish your question on nutrition.
Well, you know what? We're going to have to do a continuation because we just ran out of time. We were just getting to it. Can you come back again?
It'd be a pleasure.
Yeah, and let's start on this whole thing because I'm still not sure when I'm supposed to begin all this stuff. Yeah. So
next time we talk, we'll talk about intermittent fasting, and then we'll talk about sleep.
Fantastic. Yeah. Okay. And what's your website?
So it's Dr. Efrat Lemondre. So Dr. for doctor, and then Efrat.
Okay.
Lemondre.
Fantastic.
And if you find me on any platform, Instagram, YouTube, anything. And you put that in, you'll find me.
Fantastic. And your book, I assume, is available every place? It's not in your head?
It's not in your head on Amazon. Start there and have fun.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. We got to do this again. To be continued.
Love it.
Okay, Dr. E, thank you, and stay well.
You too. Bye-bye.
I tell you, folks, I'm a little confused, but I'm going to get it straightened out, I promise.
This is the place.
Hey!
Hey, yo, this is my grandson, Mike. It's his 18th birthday.
Man.
Wow, one of the best years of my life.
Well, when I was 18, ladies used to think I was fine.
Yeah, your grandma, maybe.
Oh, come on, man.
He's a smart guy, but I thought he could use a little advice today.
Mm-hmm.
Start putting away some money.
Call your mother.
And now that you're 18, you need to sign up with the Selective Service System.
Remember Jamie Thomas?
Yeah.
Heard he didn't register and was denied a job with TSA.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
That's it. Save money, call mom, and register with SSS.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Grandpa, this boy got that police hair, the kind that roll up and stop wherever he wants to.
That's cold, man. Just cut the boy's hair.
I don't know what to do with it.
Be the man. Register with the Selective Service System today at SSS.gov.
Good-looking boy, but ugly hair.
Talking to your kids about the dangers of vaping can be hard. Getting them to listen to hot gossip is easy. So here's some drama you could share with your kid. Dude, did you hear about Cassie and Jake? No, but did you hear that vaping can cause irreversible lung damage and nicotine affects brain development? Nuh-uh. You don't need to gossip if you want to have an open conversation about vaping. So if you want to get tips on when and how to talk to your kids, visit talkaboutvaping.org. Brought to you by the American Lung Association and the Ad Council.
You wonder, why am I playing the theme from Jaws? It's because we're in a world that is a little bit on the weird side. You know, when you say the word journalism, do we really know what it means anymore? Well, Dan Luzader is not too sure either, I don't think. He is taking a close look at journalism with two of the most controversial books around. One is called Street Talk, and the other one is The Manchurian Journalist. That's the one that I'm really fascinated with. Now, Dan is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, has been at it for over 40 years. He's also a documentary filmmaker, and still explores the role of journalism in our American democracy, which, in my opinion, is on the edge of demise. Let's put it that way. You've read his work in the New York Times and the New York Daily News, and he was named a member of the Scripps Howard Journalism Hall of Fame, and he's on with us on Pop Talk. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm good. I'm great. Good to be with you today. Thanks for having me on.
Not a problem, because this is something that I brought up on my show many times before. Because I've been in news and talk pretty much about the same amount of time as you, since 1974. That was my first television show in Indianapolis. Oh, by the way, you were from Fort Wayne?
Well, actually, I'm from Muncie, Indiana, but worked at the Indianapolis Star for about 7 years.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I had a television show on WTTV, Channel 4. In
we
Indiana.
May have run across each other at some time in the past.
Yeah, no kidding. Anyway, so it's a small world, let's put it that way.
It is.
But, you know, when I started out in the business, now it was a talk show on TV, and then I got into news, and then radio, and news, and talk, and all this. You know how the business is. In this business, you keep changing and evolving, or you don't stay in the business. But
true.
Define the word journalism for me and put it in context from when you started and I started out to what it is today. Because I don't know what journalism is today anymore.
Very few of us do, it seems. It's a wide arc to describe. But journalism, I think, means to me the process of sewing a community together. I started out on weekly newspapers and moved to dailies and got hooked after being a police reporter for a gritty daily in Muncie, Indiana.
Wow.
And I've seen every phase. I've edited weekly newspapers. I've freelanced for the New York Times and traveled. But journalism doesn't mean today what it meant when I started. It's infected by something that has changed, I think, the original intent of the Fourth Estate's role in democracy.
Okay.
It's become more entertainment, more perspective, and less news, and certainly less local news.
Gotcha. Well, and don't worry. I mean, let's throw in there the internet and social media, which has changed. I mean, talk about changing the whole idea of journalism. You don't have to prove anything on the internet. I mean, when I first started, if I'd say a fraction of what is being said on the internet, I'd have gotten thrown off like in an instant. Gone. You're done.
In a heartbeat. Yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
But what happened? You know, I don't understand what happened.
Well, there was a lot of optimism, I think, at the time when the internet was rising, and there was, it seemed, the opportunity for more people to participate in journalism, quote unquote. And the, you know, the structure of journalism may have seemed to many people somewhat elite, not all that easy to get into.
Uh-huh.
And but I think what changed, or at least the changes I've seen, have been that institutional journalism, the structure of how journalists report, how they get sources, how they become familiar with the community, a lot of that's disappeared as newspapers have disappeared. And the institutional side that I experienced so deeply with mentors who were editors and other reporters who knew the ropes, who knew sources, who knew how to be on the street and find things out, those people are gone.
It just drives me crazy. Does anybody do any fact-checking anymore?
It doesn't seem like it.
yeah.
I did an interview last week, and the interviewers were not familiar with the name of the newspaper I worked for. They were not familiar with some.
Are you serious?
The story. That's right. And I understand there's a lot of pressure on people to perform quickly, and sometimes they don't get the right information in front of them. But you know, it's a different animal for me. I believe I've done investigative reporting for most of my career. I was a columnist and then an investigative reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe in public records and in access to information. And as I look at today's options for finding information, even routine information like property transactions or getting access to the police log or doing something other than taking a press release from someone, I don't find that operating anymore.
Hmm.
You don't find that kind of information in newspapers, certainly. And what you do find is not very much hardcore journalism.
It's amazing because, I mean, when I first started doing my very first talk show, we didn't have the internet. We didn't even know what the heck it was. You got your information from magazines or print. You go to the library. Oh, my God. You know, actually went to the library. But you did the best you could and research, but then you also listen to what people are saying and feed off of the answers that you're getting instead of, I've seen this with young people a lot, and I bet you have too. They've got a list of questions, and they've got them written down. And they're not listening. They go right to the next question. You're going, stop. You know, shouldn't you be asking
right.
this question? They just brought up something that would be more interesting probably than your next question.
That's right, the ability to follow up. When I was a young reporter, I covered a meeting in which Rennie Davis, who was one of the Chicago Seven, was speaking, and a state representative was in the crowd and leaped to his feet and began to shout down Rennie Davis, and then he turned around and took off out of the stadium, out of the auditorium, and I jumped up and followed him and got thorough comment about what he thought and what his perspective was.
Yeah.
And when I got back to the newsroom, the city editor praised me for doing that. He said, that was good. You brought the more of the local opinion to your story.
Yeah.
And And following up is something really important, but we have very short attention spans.
Yeah, that's true.
As journalists, anyone.
Yeah. Well, all you have to do is look at your commercials. I mean, some of their shots are like a nine-tenths of a second, you know, and you're going, whoa, whoa, wait, let's slow down a little bit. I'd like to explore a little bit more of this, but you don't get a chance to do that anymore. But it's not healthy. It's not healthy because now we're also faced with a thing called artificial intelligence. And that's going to take it to the next, I should say, I was going to say the next level, but maybe the next lower level. I'm not sure if it's going to be the higher level. I tease on the air. I said, you know, you may be listening to my show in a few years, and you'll think it's me, but it ain't. You know, it's not me.
It could be. We have enough trouble sorting out now what's misinformation and disinformation.
Yes.
And now, as it's put together with artificial intelligence in sophisticated ways, I'm sure there are algorithms that can make that even harder to figure out.
But
what's true and what
so
isn't.
Where the heck are we going? I mean, I say I'm glad I'm old. I don't think I want to live through that.
Well, I do think that there's ways that we can recover some of what's been lost. I hope. And I think it's so important, especially now, with all the political division that's going on.
We are so polarized, Dan. I don't think we'll ever come together again. Is there any issue that can bring this country back together again? Unless it's a war.
I wonder. And that speaks to history, certainly.
Yeah.
That has been the case in the past. But the division, I think, is fed by the polarization in the media, and it's hard to tell which came first, chicken or the egg, whether the political polarization we see started with a similar divide in media not covering things down the middle of the road, but either from the left or the right.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy, too, because, a lot of people will watch Fox News. A lot of people will watch CNN. I said, don't you watch both? And they go, why would I? Because you need to know the whole story, you know, before you make a decision. And they're usually, 180 degrees separated from each other. You know, you listen to one, did I listen to that other one? It's so different than this one. You need to know both of them. But people don't do that anymore.
No, they don't. And there was, for all the faults that were in newspapers, and newspapers were my orientation, for all the faults that existed, there still was an effort internally to get things right, to make sure that down to minute detail that you were correct. One of the things I remember from early as a young reporter was the city editor saying to me, now, is that street or avenue in this address? And it made a huge difference because if you were writing about somebody committing a crime and you got the right number in the right street but called it avenue instead of street, it was a different place and a different person. You might incur liability.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
And by accusing the wrong person. And those kinds of things were drilled into us day by day as, you know, we were out on the street.
But, I mean, the real investigations like you've done. I mean, you did that. The whole thing in Fort Wayne with the great flood and in your book called Street Talk. But I don't know. Would there ever be a Watergate today, the investigation? I don't know.
I think there could be, but unfortunately I don't agree that Watergate was what it was purported to be.
Really?
No.
Why?
In fact, my book, The Manchurian Journalist, addresses some of that because one of the things I discovered as I was researching the relationship between the American intelligence community and journalism and efforts to propagandize the American public domestically from World War II on and the Cold War issues, began to see that the distortions, the perspectives out of the intelligence community were seeping into our news columns, and it was purposeful. Mm. And when I was looking at that, I discovered a book called Silent Coup by Lynn Kolodny, who had taken a hard look at Bob Woodward's prior history before he became a reporter at mm-hmm. the Washington Post. And he'd been an intelligence officer with the Navy, and he was a briefer at the White House
mm-hmm.
Immediately before he took a job on a small newspaper and then moved quickly over to the Washington Post and was assigned to Watergate.
Okay.
And the intelligence links raise questions for me because they're not discussed, they're not disclosed, and his history is not generally disclosed. You have to go look for it. And, you know, Carl Bernstein, his partner, wrote in the Rolling Stone in the late 1970s about Operation Mockingbird, the CIA's infiltration of the American media and foreign media. But there was more to it than Bernstein ever wrote about. There were active efforts to recruit individuals into publishing, into media, into journalism, who had sympathetic ideas with perspectives on the Cold War. And that intelligence network was much broader than the CIA itself. It involved individuals who were powerful in the banking and legal communities.
Well, that hasn't changed.
No, it hasn't. And so that system of recruiting and trying to sway the American public in certain directions about
now,
what we should or shouldn't believe has been a problem in journalism since World War II.
So the book, The Manchurian Journalist, I mean, when you say that, it reminds me of, you know, The Manchurian Candidate.
Exactly.
And right. Mind control. And are yeah. you, is that what you're talking about then?
Well, not so much mind control, but what I'm talking about is where does a journalist's loyalties lie and what are the influences on that journalist? We know in general terms, I think, about a lot of journalists and what their history and influences have been. But in this particular case, I took a look at Lawrence Wright, who's a writer for The New Yorker and very prominent. He won a Pulitzer in 2007 for his investigation of Al-Qaeda mm-hmm. and the War on Terror. But his history turned out to be something far different than what the public knows about. And in investigating his history, I discovered that he had close relationships to the very people that were responsible for creating this intelligence network to recruit journalists and recruit people into the publishing industry, really as part of the Cultural Cold War. His father was a close friend and employee of one of those very prominent players, Robert Story from Dallas, who was head of the American Bar Association, head of the International Bar Association, chief executive trial prosecutor at the Nuremberg War Trials, head of the Board of Foreign Scholarships. And he never mentioned Robert Story or that relationship in all of the things that he has written.
And
I found that curious, and the further I looked, I found he was connected to intelligence-related programs for recruiting in the U.S. and in Egypt at the American University in Cairo.
So, you know, we can go back to any major event that happened, and there always could be some questions. I mean, we can go back to the JFK assassination. That's still up for grabs. You know, then nobody's really stopped talking about it. Or 9/11. And what happened. What's your take on 9/11?
One of the things I found really interesting as I was researching what Lawrence Wright was his own notation that he wrote a script for a movie called The Siege. And it was the movie had Denzel Washington and Annette Bening in it, and it was about a terrorist attack in New York City. And that movie came out in, I believe it was 1998 or 99, immediately before, just 2 years before the terrorist attack. And there were similar descriptions of people involved, terrorists, individuals, whatever. And the similarities were very striking. And those kinds of things, when in dealing with a situation where an individual I know has had direct contact with those powerful people involved in influencing through the intelligence network American perspectives, it makes me wonder, was the movie, The Siege, some kind of preparation?
Yeah, but you can do that with almost any story. I mean,
I think
we could go to, you know, the landing on the moon. And there's a movie that's coming out now, and I haven't seen it or anything yet, but I saw the trailer. And it talks about that there was a production, in case they didn't make it to the moon, that they would then use this production, a film, that looks like exactly what happened on the moon. So it's like, I mean, who knows what the truth is anymore?
Yeah. Well, and as we explore this entertainment media and these ideas, we do begin to wonder. I mean, Hollywood has had a tremendous impact as well.
Oh, yeah.
In its own sort of journalism and creating public perspectives. And the book, again, addresses some of the history of that and people involved in helping shape censorship in relation to the Cold War.
So make me feel better. Is there going to be any change? Can we go back to not necessarily back in time, but back to really looking at truth? Or has there ever been any truth? I don't know.
Oh, I think there has been. I think there was good factual reporting along the way, and a lot of things in local, regional, national communities really to depend on. I think there has been truth, but we've gotten away from that by being sloppy in what we do and being reactive in how we report. And we have, you know, the most popular news channels on the left or the right, with their own perspective, and we tend to listen to one or the other, which contributes to more of this polarization. But I think, you know, I'm a little more optimistic. I think that we can recognize what's happening to independent journalism. Independence and transparency are the axis on which, you know, truth turns. And people can have a bias as they report. If it's transparent and we all know about it, then I think it makes it easier to deal with. But I think what we're lacking is good, foundational, accurate reporting. That kind that occurred when I was coming up through the business. You know, we don't have that network of newspapers anymore that contributed from local communities the news of what was going on there and picked up by Associated Press or United Press International and distributed to other newspapers all over the country. It tied us together in many ways. But we don't have those contributors anymore.
No.
I worked for the Rocky Mountain News for 10 years in Denver, and the Rocky Mountain News is gone. It's a one newspaper town now, to its detriment. But it used to have a very vigorous journalistic environment. And when I covered Columbine, I was on the inside of the police investigation into Columbine. And an incident from that really speaks to me now about what has happened with newspapers. I was on the outs with editors at the time that Columbine happened, and they had sent me down to cover the Colorado State House, which was a good assignment for a lot of people, but I wanted to do investigative reporting. That's why I came there. And so I wasn't called back to the newsroom when Columbine happened.
Oh boy.
Most reporters were called in, but I was left down at the State House, and I didn't get a call the first or second day. And on the third day, I got a call from the city editor, and he said, "We have a problem, and we need some help." And I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "We let police beat slide. We haven't had anybody covering the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department for a long time, and the Denver Post has an active police reporter." And so he said, "We're not even able to find out who's running the investigation."
Oh,
I said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Find out who's running the investigation." And I said, "Okay, give me a little time and I'll call you back." So I had done an investigation into an attempt by organized crime to take over the Denver taxi industry. And in the course of that, I discovered drug running and gun running by using the taxis in Denver. And I developed some sources in the gun running industry.
Good for
and
you.
So I started calling those sources, and I found an informant who had worked with cops, and I asked him what they were looking at. And he said they're figuring out where the guns came from that the kids used in the killings. And I said, what's the lead? He said, I can't tell you. He said, but I think if you'll look at a homicide of a police officer that happened a couple of years ago, you'll find out the guns came from the same place that gun came from.
Wow.
So I called the newspaper's library, and I asked him who with the sheriff's department had investigated the killing of Officer Timothy Mossbrecher. And he gave me the name, and I called that officer and left a voicemail since they weren't answering any phones. And I just asked, where did the gun come from that was used in that killing? And I got a call 15 minutes later from the guy who was running the investigation. And he said, I want to know why you asked that question. Mm-hmm. He said, meet me for coffee and I'll tell you. And we did, and after that, I was on the inside of the investigation.
Amazing.
With the officers for the next 2 months. So,
well, whatever happened to Cronkite is what I want to know. You know, no Cronkites anymore.
Yeah.
But
who reported to us, you know, what was factual and accurate, and
didn't get an opinion. Everybody's got
journalistic integrity.
Everybody's got a friggin' opinion now. You know, and it's like. Yeah. As a reporter, you shouldn't have an opinion. You're a reporter, not,
right.
You know, go get your own talk show. Then you can have an opinion. You know? So what, do you have a website?
I don't. That's something I probably need to do.
Yeah.
I'm so old-fashioned.
Stop it. You got to have a website. The book, The Manchurian Journalist or Street Talk, available where?
On Amazon, they're very available from Trine Day, the publisher, and Barnes & Noble.
Well, all I can say is that this is just the beginning of the conversation because it ain't done yet, Dan. I wish it was, but it's not.
I don't
know where we're going to go from here. The Internet, I mean, anybody can say anything. They say, oh, no, you have to prove. No, you don't. You just, and the younger people especially, well, I saw it on the Internet. I said, did you check it? Well, why would I? Was on the Internet. Yeah. So? But they don't get it. They don't get it.
It's hard even for people who are skeptical to tell
the truth?
What's true or what isn't.
Isn't that scary?
And so the rest of us are at their mercy, I think.
Yeah. Well, we better do something because our country is going to be flailing for a long time if we don't figure out how to come together and keep democracy going, because I honestly feel that democracy is on a precipice right now. What do you think?
I think without good journalism, there won't be any democracy. And without democracy, there won't be any journalism.
That's true. You're right. Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I hope you'll come back and visit again.
I'd love to. Anytime. I'd love to talk about the business.
I never would have guessed. It's great, Dan. Thank you so much for taking the time, really. And we'll talk again soon.
Okay.
Take care. Once again, that's Dan Luzader. It's Luzader. The two books, Street Talk and The Manchurian Journalist. And I'm telling you, a lot to be said about what's going on. So I'll leave you with this saying, okay? This came of all people. Angelina Jolie had this, and it kind of fits into what we're talking about. I don't believe in regret. I feel everything leads us to where we are, and we have to just jump forward, mean well, commit, and just see what happens. Well, that's where we are in this world, I'm telling you right now. In the meantime, as I always say, live simply, laugh often, love deeply, and above all else, dare to dream. Because if you don't have the dream, how do you make the dream come true? We'll talk with you next time right here on Pop Talk. Mary Jane Pop saying, have a great one.